He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. My name is Andrew Sola, and I'm at the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany. Today, we will be discussing Native American perspectives on the Declaration of Independence, and my guest, whom you just heard reading that troubling passage, is Matthew Kruer. Matthew is assistant professor of early American history at the University of Chicago. He wrote the book, Time of Anarchy, Indigenous Power and the Crisis of Colonialism in Early America, published by Harvard University Press in 2021. He also serves as the University of Chicago's liaison to the Newberry Consortium in American Indian and Indigenous Studies, which links universities across the U.S. and Canada engaged in Indigenous Studies. So Matthew, you're an expert on Indigenous history and the Declaration of Independence. I'm sure you've read that ugly passage a million times. So what do you think when you read that passage?
You're right. I have read that passage a lot, and it features often in the classes that I teach to draw students' attention to that being there amongst the grievances that colonists are hurling toward the British crown. And that phrase, merciless Indian savages, it's jarring. I think it's notable that a lot of indigenous peoples in the 21st century consider that word savages to be a slur. And it can be painful to hear. It can be painful for students to hear, especially native students who are in these classes. And so I think the fact that this document that we associate with kind of soaring aspirations, the fact that it includes this incredibly ugly sentiment is something that I've never fully stopped sitting with and trying to figure out exactly how to feel about that.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable, but hopefully through our discussion today, at least we can start exploring the context around why it was put in and maybe tease out some other lessons from it. I've just been reading this great book, which I will also recommend besides Matthew's book, but it's Ned Blackhawk's fascinating book about Native Americans. It's called The Rediscovery of America. And there are just some stats that I think I want to throw out to you, Matthew, and to the audience, just so we can get a sense of the basic demographic statistics of North America in the 1600s and the 1700s. And I think it's important to realize this, that when Columbus came to the New World in 1492, it's estimated that there were 7 to 8 million indigenous people in North America. By the time the Declaration of Independence was released in 1776, that number halved to 4 million. And I mean, part of what we're going to do today is hopefully understand the story of getting from 7 to 8 million to 4 million. And just to localize this in the United States, in the Northeast, or the colonies at the time. In 1600, in the Northeast, there were approximately 150,000 indigenous people living there. And by 1700, so only 100 years later, that number dropped to 15,000. So in 100 years, a 90% decrease in the indigenous population. Third and final stat, maybe. I didn't realize this, but there were at least 1 million Native Americans who were enslaved in North America during the 16th and 17th centuries. I know a little bit about indigenous history, but not a lot. I think one point that I think of with these statistics is to remember that there are multiple perspectives of viewing indigenous history and American colonial history. Obviously, there's the Western perspective, and then the Native American perspective, but I think that ignores sort of a third point that I always find interesting, is that those two perspectives aren't separate. They totally intersect, like, in so many different fascinating ways. And we have intermarriages between Europeans and native peoples. We have the exchange of knowledge, the learning of each other's languages, and in fact, trade. So I think the story we're always telling is one of these intersectional stories. And that's maybe where I just want to kind of start this discussion before we get into more historical specifics. How do we start thinking and managing all of these different perspectives? And how do you do that with your students, Matt?
Well, I think that's a really good point to start with, is that diversity when we think about Native America and the histories of Native America. And I use the plural word histories because, you know, I think for non-Native folks nowadays, it can be really easy to think about a binary between, you know, Native people and kind of everybody else, or, you know, white settlers. And Native people are absolutely not a monolith. they are not now and were not at any point in the past. Just to give you a sort of a quick sense of how much diversity we're talking about, in 2025, there are 574 federally recognized indigenous nations in the United States. And that's not even counting groups that are recognized by states, but not by the federal government. And it's not including the over 600 First Nations in Canada. So we're talking about an enormously large, diverse set of independent societies and separate sovereign nations whose histories, whose perspectives cannot be collapsed into just sort of one, like, indigenous perspective. So we always have to think about this in the plural, I think. And the second thing, as you gestured toward, is absolutely correct, that indigenous perspectives are not diametrically opposed to settler perspectives. In fact, especially throughout the period of early America, you know, let's just say arbitrarily up until 1800 or so, quote-unquote colonial society was incredibly deeply intermeshed with Native societies and vice versa. There were all kinds of regular contacts, you know, Native people who, you know, visited colonial towns on a regular basis, who intermarried with colonial people. A lot of the leadership of Native nations by the time we get to the late 18th century have some kind of mixed background. You know, they have parentage from one or more Native nations, as well as, you know, European descended peoples, as well as people of African descent, you know, depending on sort of which context we're talking about. And all of those influences are really quite pronounced, especially in the later part of the 18th century, when Native people are engaging with settler, you know, sort of European, Euro-American culture in deep, deep ways through religious conversions and encounters with various denominations of Protestant Christianity, as well as Catholicism, who have been taught in missionary schools and speak English fluently, who travel to London and Europe and meet, you know, different members of high society within imperial capitals, who are cosmopolitan, right? Who are complex cultural figures that not only exist within Native societies as sort of, you know, full members of these cultures and these nations, but are also, you know, deeply in tune with the currents of, you know, Enlightenment thought, of revolutionary kind of ferment, and all of the kind of developments that we tend to associate with places just like Boston or New York or Philadelphia.
Do you just want to comment a little bit on the context around the population loss? Because that is a fact that, you know, we can't ignore. So I think that the big cause is, maybe we all know, disease, warfare, and enslavement. So Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, those are the big three. You know, the population loss in the historical scholarship, there's a long debate about this, because initially there was a compelling argument that essentially that Native people had no pre-existing immunity to a variety of European diseases. And so they experienced what were called virgin soil epidemics, right? They had no natural immunities, and they had no kind of like existing healing procedures to cope with these diseases. And that perspective has been largely discredited. there really is not that much evidence that Native people, you know, just like encountered European diseases and then sort of instantly died off. It's more complicated than that, and it is connected to colonialism, right? Oftentimes, in fact, almost always, when you see these epidemics that are really devastating to Native communities, it's because of various conditions that allow those epidemics to spread. For example, when Native people are engaged in warfare, often with settlers, and are crowded into, like, lots of refugees are in a small enclosed space where there's not a lot of sanitation. People are suffering from malnutrition, right? All kinds of factors that weaken people's immune systems and make them susceptible to diseases. There's also really great evidence, wonderful work by the scholar Paul Kelton, who has shown that Native peoples did, in fact, develop very sophisticated techniques for healing, for dealing with epidemic diseases, including a sort of like an independent invention of quarantine protocols and things like that. So it's not that Native people didn't have defenses against disease. It's really just that it was a continuous onslaught from various forms of violence that came from the process of colonization that included, to some extent, new diseases, sort of a new disease ecology, conditions that lowered people's immune systems that came from warfare and refugee migrations, and the violence of processes like large-scale enslavement, which contributed to all of these things. So the population loss is 100% real, and Native people today often call it the Great Dying, this sort of this across the board over a longer period of time, like around a century or so, this 90% loss of people and everything that that involves, right, in terms of traumatic sort of social ruptures, the loss of elders and the kind of knowledge and expertise and leadership that elders offer, you know, all kinds of ripple effects that really provide, that create destabilizing influences across the continent.
Right. The geographical push westward actually also meant that certain Native tribes, because they were getting squeezed from one direction, would naturally squeeze over to the other, and sometimes as a consequence of being moved to the west, would encounter other tribes who would then sort of get pushed further. They'd have maybe negative interactions with them, and there was kind of this ripple effect to the west. Is that generally speaking accurate?
It is. And in fact, there's a really incredible story that's directly related to the American Revolution in regards to this, because the historian Elizabeth Fenn has a great book called Pox Americana that traces a smallpox epidemic during the American Revolution itself, right? This sort of...
Great pun, by the way.
Yeah. And it affected everybody, right? It affected Continental soldiers and British soldiers, and it affected civilians. It affected, you know, enslaved people. And it percolated across the continent because these conditions of sort of warfare and dislocation provided an incredible set of vectors for that disease to spread. So I think that's a really good example of the ways that, you know, dislocations that come from, you know, conditions of violence, from warfare.
I think maybe we should just use the word refugees. Yeah. In the sense we talk about refugees now, they were refugees.
Yeah, I think a lot of them were. That's absolutely right.
One last point before we get into the specifics of this passage in the Declaration that I think is interesting. I think there's this misperception that somehow Native tribes weren't trading basically globally, or at least throughout North America and Central America, and that they had nothing like urban centers or cities. And just one final interesting stat about that, and I want you to talk about, is that in the year 1700, the combined populations of the great cities in North America, Boston, New York, and Philadelphia, was only 13,000 people combined. And again, Black Hawk argues that the Mandan tribe on the banks of the Missouri had multiple cities consisting of 10 to 20,000 people. I mean, 10,000, and then during trading fairs, they would get more. But again, I think that's something that I always had the misperception of, that there wasn't something like stable native, maybe not metropolises, but urban centers, at least along the Mississippi. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think the story of urban centers in North America is an underappreciated one. And it's partially because a lot of the big urban centers were either much reduced or abandoned by the time that we get to the, you know, the 18th century, at least in the eastern part of the continent. But, you know, just to pick one example, the Mississippi River Valley had a large number of very sort of like city states, I think might be a good way to describe them. They were stratified societies. They had bureaucratic administrations. They had kings or sort of hierarchical leaders who were combined monarchical and spiritual powers. They were very much a city. and the biggest one, Cahokia, which is located just a little bit east of what's now St. Louis, you know, in around the year 1400, had a population of roughly 30,000 or more. So it was, you know, it was just around the size of London at the same time. You know, it was the size of not just American capitals, but European capitals. And so, you know, the Mississippian cities did kind of experience a process of reduction and dispersal. And there's a lot of interesting scholarship about the forces behind that. Some of them were climactic, some of them were sort of socio-political. But that's not to say that urban centers disappeared, you know. The Mandan is a good example. The pueblos of the Southwest are another really good example, which, you know, existed before European contact and continue to exist today in the same places. So, you know, so cities and concentrated urban populations were not universal across the continent by any means, but they did exist. And they're a really important part of this history that, as you say, I think is not widely known.
And one final point on that. Can you talk about the vast trading networks and economic systems throughout North America? Yeah, real quickly. just because it's another misconception. I mean, but, you know, I think archaeologists are finding and dig stuff from Inuit populations and Central and South American populations. So clearly trading was going on, which was basically throughout the Western Hemisphere, is the way I understand it. And I'm not no expert.
Yeah, that's right. Archaeologists have uncovered evidence of enormous chains of trade. Like just one example is the presence of obsidian in Great Lakes native communities, right? Like sites of towns and villages, which in some cases comes from the area that's now Mexico. In other cases, there's other materials, minerals that come from the Rocky Mountains. So we're talking about trade networks that span thousands of miles. Another really good example is the widespread practice of using wampum for diplomatic agreements, for treaty making, right?
Yeah, wampum, you need to explain wampum, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Wampum is made from two different marine animals, quahog and I'm going to forget the other name. Whelk, made from quahog and whelk shells. And those are primarily found in Long Island Sound. This is not necessarily a widely dispersed habitat for these creatures. And so wampum was made into the sort of the shells were processed into beads, and the beads were made into strings, and then the strings were crafted into belts. And the belts always had some sort of pattern, right, that was meant to commemorate a specific occasion, because the wampum belts were often exchanged, right? They were a gift from one native nation to another native nation on some sort of formal occasion, a council or a peace treaty. And they represented the truth and the sincerity of whatever speech was being given, and then served as a kind of a device that commemorated that the agreement that ultimately came to it. It was a kind of a
something
a
like
historical
a contract
record.
We would understand as like something like a contract.
Yeah, I think in a it's a bit of a stretch, but it is useful to think about this as a version of the way that Europeans wrote out treaty agreements and then signed them and kept the physical treaty, right? Because that was meant to be a binding agreement. Wampum similarly represented a kind of a way of binding people together, the, you know, making material, the oral exchanges that people had made. So it was a very important political and sort of sacred substance. And the exchange of wampum belts was common throughout Eastern North America. Like pretty much, every society east of the Mississippi River engaged in this sort of diplomacy that involved wampum exchanges. And those shells, basically come from just that body of water in Long Island, like Long Island Sound. So I think that gives you another indication of just sort of the extent to which material exchanges linked Native peoples across the continent over long, very, very long distances.
So basically what we're saying, and I just wanted to come right out and say it and show it, these are extremely sophisticated societies who are encountering now other very sophisticated societies, and that takes us into these interactions we see in the colonies. So, and all of this, of course, leads up to that ugly passage about the Indians whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So let's go now more specifically into the Declaration of Independence and the context around this. And I think you wanted to start with the imperial crisis. So could you maybe give our audience some sense of where we're starting, and then we can get into these points.
Sure. To telegraph where I'm headed with this imperial crisis, I want to make the point that for Native people, especially in the area around the Ohio Valley, the area just to the west of the Appalachian Mountains, the Declaration of Independence was not in any way a rupture or a new development. It was a continuation of dynamics that had been affecting their worlds in profound ways for at least two decades. And so, the imperial crisis, like this really starts with the Seven Years' War, which was primarily a struggle, or at least started as a struggle, between British Empire and the French Empire over the Ohio Valley. And once the Seven Years' War was over, when the British Empire basically diplomatically took the entirety of what had previously been New France and folded it into the British Empire, that marked a sea change for Native peoples, Native nations, who had been used to living in a kind of a multipolar imperial world. People living in the Ohio Valley had been for decades able to engage in what scholars often call the imperial playoff system, right? They were able to use the fact that both the British and the French wanted their allegiance, wanted their trade, wanted either their military capabilities or their sort of diplomatic heft. Both of these European empires competed for influence over Native peoples, and therefore Native peoples had leverage, right? They could sort of pick and choose between which of these imperial powers they wanted to ally with or be able to sort of negotiate better terms of trade agreements and treaties and so on. Suddenly that's gone, right? After the Seven Years' War, by the time we get to 1763, that's gone. And Native peoples no longer have the ability to appeal to a French authority or to threaten British officials with a defection to the French side.
So we're just talking about basically raw power now. Since the Ohio Valley has been ceded to the British, as you said, they can't appeal for, say, weapons or assistance from the French government or the French military. So it's just a power thing. And they've realized now, the Native peoples, well, we are disadvantaged now because we don't have access to some of this raw military power. Or is that a reduction?
I think it's a little bit reductive, but it is very much a part of things because of the policies that the British officials adopt in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War.
By the way, I'm sorry, is this the French and Indian War?
Yes.
Why do we have two separate words for this or terms for this?
So the Seven Years' War is what they generally called it in Europe. In the American colonies, the British, they called it the French and Indian War, which is hugely inaccurate. That's the reason I tend not to use that term, is because Native peoples fought on both sides of the so-called French and Indian War for the entire period.
Yeah, so the idea that audience, like the British... the audience needs to remember this. Native peoples fought on both sides of the conflict.
Yes, absolutely.
But it ends in 1763. So yeah, back to the imperial crisis right. in 1763. Sorry.
So it ends in 1763. The Treaty of Paris results in the French Empire ceding all of this territory to the British. And British officials, specifically the commander-in-chief of the British Army, Geoffrey Amherst, essentially decides unilaterally to end the system of diplomacy with indigenous peoples that had prevailed for well over a century. By system of diplomacy, what I mean is that the process of engaging in treaty councils and doing things like exchanging wampum belts and making agreements for trade that the British had to uphold, or even the indigenous protocol of gift giving, right? That was a very, very important part of native diplomacy and political relationships. And, you know, for the entire period up until this, up until 1763, Europeans of all stripes had to do that sort of gift-giving procedure, even when it kind of irritated them, because they just knew that without that process of kind of reciprocal gift-giving and promises of ongoing relationships, that diplomacy would not work. So Amherst comes in, and you know, because the British Empire had contracted such an enormous debt in waging the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War, he decided no more gifts, right? We're not doing diplomacy this way anymore. We have conquered these people, and we are now going to govern them. And that did not sit well with any of these native nations, as you can imagine.
Yeah, but there are some modern, contemporary resonances to what you were just saying, too. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, and native people were very clear about this. There was the Anishinaabe leader, Minavana, told British officials, right? So this was a group that had been fighting alongside the French. They had opposed the British during the previous war. So in a military sense, they had been defeated, right? But they hadn't been conquered, because the British don't control any of this territory. And suddenly Amherst is saying, you know, well, you are conquered and you have to play by our rules now, and we're not doing any kind of diplomacy the way that you understand it. And so Minavana specifically said to British officials, you have conquered the French, but you have not conquered us. We are not your slaves. And I think that's a really, I think, powerful encapsulation of the problem here, right, in 1763, is that the British officials in North America are trying to govern this hugely expanded territory, but they're trying to do it on the cheap because the empire is so strapped for financial resources. And so this results pretty directly in the conflict that has a variety of different names, but is usually called Pontiac's War, a sort of a huge multinational indigenous attack on British outposts throughout the sort of the Western territories that was incredibly successful. You know, the different native nations, sometimes working on their own, sometimes working in concert with each other, destroyed 9 out of the 14 British forts in the continental interior, sort of west of the Appalachian Mountains, and to some extent a little bit east of that. They proved that native nations, even though they had, you know, kind of quote unquote been defeated, in fact had the power to fight on their own and bring the British Empire to heel, at least temporarily, to inflict really serious damage, such that it was better for British officials to make some kind of concessions rather than try to spend additional financial resources to bring to bear the military force that they would have to subdue all of these different native nations. So Pontiac's War is sort of, it's directly connected to the promulgation of the Proclamation of 1763, right? This was an imperial decree that essentially used the crest of the Appalachian Mountains as a dividing line that said, east of this line is settler space, and west of this line is, as it was labeled on the map, land reserved for Indians. And the idea there was that...
Did anyone agree to that on the native side?
Or was, no one it was agreed just to that on any side.
It was just was this King George or who exactly did this?
Yeah, it was a royal proclamation.
Okay, royal proclamation.
And it was intended to be part of a whole series of reforms that imperial officials in London were engaging in order to try to create some sort of ordered administrative structure in the newly conquered territories, including, you know, Quebec, what's now Canada, the Floridas. There's a bunch of different provisions that go along with this. You know, the Proclamation of 1763 also sets up governments for these new territories, right, for the conquered settler populations. The line that establishes the land reserve for Indians is the imperial attempt to separate settler and native populations such that peace is going to be possible, right? Such that there won't be the kind of friction that leads to disorganized violence between settlers and natives that the imperial center can't control and could spiral very quickly into a much wider war. The problem with the Proclamation of 1763 is that it was not, I mean, first of all, it wasn't the result of any discussion with native leaders.
Well, that's what I was about to say. I mean, you can proclaim all you want, but if you got to proclaim to someone, if they're not getting the message, what's the point?
Right. That is one of the issues. The other issue is that it also wasn't something that was discussed with colonial leaders. Huh. And colonial leaders, and not even leaders, just like British colonists at every social level, consider this proclamation a profound betrayal. Right, they had just spent almost a decade fighting an incredibly demanding, destructive, violent war, in part to conquer this very territory, right, in order to take away native homelands for themselves, for the expansion of these colonies. And suddenly, once they win, the government in London says, nope, actually, you can't have that land. That's land reserved for the Indians, right, as the map says. And for colonists, all the way from, you know, land speculators like George Washington and George Mason, down to poor settlers, recent immigrants who are just sort of looking for their own patch of land, all of them see this as the empire taking the side of native peoples against British subjects. Right, that's the betrayal, is that when the empire is trying to protect native people, trying to protect native land, that is unacceptable to them. And that is one of the first things that sort of sets in motion stirrings of settler defiance of the imperial government, of the idea that, like, it really kind of starts settlers thinking about the possibility that their government is actually not working on their behalf.
Is there some sense that they did this going back to the great debt that the British government had incurred through the Seven Years' War? And I know, like, the Stamp Act, for example, was one effort to try to claw back some revenue and to pay off these debts. In what sort of financial context is this proclamation? How do you see that? Was there a specific financial benefit they thought from this?
Yeah, it's directly related. You know, Amherst's decision to stop the practice of diplomatic gift giving, that was a significant expense. I should make it clear that when I say gift giving, I don't mean, you know, like, here's a nice,
right,
you know,
pistol.
Yeah, that was sometimes a part of it. But the amount of gifts that could be a part of a single diplomatic meeting could run into thousands of pounds sterling.
Wow.
So this was
so
a significant,
like, cash.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the gifts involved a whole lot of things, including actually weapons, including guns and gunpowder and ammunition. That was a sort of a very well established part of these diplomatic exchanges. And, you know, you can imagine that cutting off the supply of weapons so soon after a war could very much be read, and was read by native leaders, as an aggressive act, right? The prelude to some sort of more open aggression to directly conquer their territories, because, what, you know, if they don't have those weapons, how are they going to resist? But the financial aspect is 100% accurate, right? The whole idea of this dividing line is to make sure that it is cheaper for the British government to regulate this Western territory than it would be if they were trying to manage large-scale settlement, if they were trying to wage wars against native nations that had just proven their power.
They were basically saying they needed to protect, the British Empire needed to protect itself from overexpansion. Is that another way of looking at this?
I think in the short term, yes. Or at the very least, they wanted to make sure that the British Empire expanded in an orderly fashion. I should say one of the other provisions of the Proclamation of 1763 was giving land grants to colonial veterans of the Seven Years' War, but not in the West, in Florida and in Canada, right? So they part of the project in the proclamation was to encourage settlement north and south rather than west. So, you know, I think the idea was not necessarily to restrict settlement. It was to make settlement orderly and give the empire enough time to sort of, you know, get its footing back, to get its finances straight before confronting native nations again. I don't think that there's any doubt that the proclamation was viewed in London as a temporary measure.
So here we are at the imperial crisis. Pontiac's War is happening. When does Pontiac's War end?
1764. It's okay, relatively
so,
short.
So we're in 1764. We're getting closer slowly to the Declaration of Independence. What's the next part of the story that you think is important to tell?
So I think the next part of the story that's important is the forms of violence that occur during Pontiac's War, which is very much an extension of the previous Seven Years' War, result in incredibly intense levels of Indian hating amongst colonists, especially those who are farthest west and most exposed to native attacks. And this is sort of especially true in Pennsylvania, the area that was, you know, kind of the gateway to the Ohio country in the Susquehanna Valley and around Fort Pitt. And people in that area, settlers in that area, had suffered a lot of really devastating native attacks, particularly from Delawares and Shawnees. The forms of warfare from native peoples were not just about military targets, right? They were also intending to push back settlement, right? Because from their point of view, this was their homeland, and settlers had invaded their homeland. So it wasn't just about attacking military targets. It was about destroying settlements and frightening people enough that they would return east and stay out of native homelands. So, you know, as you can imagine, this gets really, really ugly very, very quickly. And by the end of that conflict, after many, many incidents of, you know, torture and mutilation, settler massacres of indigenous peoples like the Conestoga, there's a really like an attitude amongst settlers that hardens, that is just intensely anti-Indian, right? That is in many ways just opposed on principle to the idea that settlers and natives can live side by side. And it's important to stress that this is a new thing, right? As I said at the outset, early America was very much an intertwined world of natives and settlers. And so this idea that comes about in the 1760s, 1750s, 1760s, the idea that coexistence is not really possible is a really dangerous and dark new development, right? And this reaches a particular high point in 1765. There's a group of vigilantes that come to be known as the Black Boys because they have the habit of painting themselves black. They sort of do what Philip DeLoria has called playing Indian. They would literally dress up kind of as what they imagined native warriors to do in order to sort of engage surreptitiously in extra legal violence. And what the Black Boys do is they essentially say, you know, it is absolutely unacceptable for the imperial government to engage in diplomacy with native peoples of any kind. And in fact, they claim the right, based on a kind of a local self-sovereignty, to police their own territories, right, their communities, to the point that they say, we will not allow any kind of trade or diplomatic caravans from, you know, the East to pass into the Ohio Valley. They state that the empire does not have the authority, does not have the legitimate authority to engage in this kind of diplomacy. And they go so far as to fire on imperial soldiers that are guarding a caravan of diplomatic goods. This happens in early, I believe it's March 1765. They lay siege to a British fort at one point during this confrontation.
So far, far before Lexington and Concord, there were colonials actually shooting weapons at British regulars.
Yes, exactly.
Good.
And
wow.
Yes.
Interesting.
And you know, you mentioned Ned Blackhawk's book, The Rediscovery of America. You know, he characterizes this as, in many ways, the first shots fired in the American Revolution, because it's for exactly the same justifications that colonists at Lexington and Concord fire their shots, right? It's because they believe that the imperial authority in this context is illegitimate. They claim the right to govern themselves according to the sort of, at the very least, regulating native relations. And they are willing to engage in armed resistance in order to enforce that. And, you know, and it's relevant that this is all happening at the same time as riots in eastern cities and, you know, the sort of the resistance to the Stamp Act taxes. And in fact, you know, there's an incredible equation of these two different contexts by Sir William Johnson, the superintendent of Indian Affairs at the time. He essentially says, you know, the black boys are equivalent to the Sons of Liberty as, quote unquote, enemies to the British Constitution.
Hmm.
And so this Western context, this sort of native context of the imperial crisis is hugely important. And I think part of the reason for that is because it welds together opposition to or critique of imperial rule with intense, violent anti-Indigenous sentiment, right? In the Western places like Pennsylvania, for people like the Black Boys, these are 100% linked and inextricable.
Okay, so we have the Black Boys, and you say there's now very much a breakdown in relations, and it's violent and ugly. So what is the next step in our story that gets us to the Declaration?
So over the course of the next decade, let's just say, to make a complicated story somewhat straightforward, the situation west of the Appalachian Mountains kind of steadily degenerates. There are attempts by British officials to negotiate some sort of lasting diplomatic agreement. There's a couple more land cessions from big treaties like the Treaty of Fort Stanwix and the Treaty of Hard Labor, Stanwix in the north and Hard Labor in the south, that kind of extends that settlements line from the proclamation farther west. None of this matters. The problem is that the imperial government, imperial forces are unable to restrain the movement of settlers west in defiance of all of these different attempts to regulate their activities. So you have, you know, between, let's say, 1763 and 1774, just a kind of a flood of settlers that are invading native homelands. Just to give you a sense of numbers, by 1763, there were almost no settlers west of the Appalachian Mountains. There were a few, but it was very, very few. By 1774, there were 50,000 settlers west of the Appalachian Mountains, right? Just in less than a decade, or just about a decade. So this is a huge, unregulated flood of people who, like the Black Boys, are deeply uninterested in coexistence with native peoples, who are willing to engage in violence to claim territory, and are not interested in following imperial attempts to, you know, impose order on any of this. They are entirely willing to go it on their own, to wage war on their own, and to defy imperial authorities, including the imperial army. This kind of culminates on the eve of the revolution in 1774. There is a conflict in the area that's now Kentucky and West Virginia called Dunmore's War, right? So this was a territory that was claimed both by Pennsylvania and Virginia. But the governor of Virginia, who was Lord Dunmore, essentially tried to gin up conflict in a very cynical kind of way. He thought that by encouraging settler conflict with native peoples in this territory, it would Number one, curry favor with elite colonists, many of whom were land speculators that had a financial interest in that territory. And number
like
two,
George
just
Washington.
Like George Washington, exactly. This was largely connected to what had been the Ohio Company of Virginia, what by this point was called the Grand Ohio Company, that had investors not just in Virginia, but all over. Benjamin Franklin was another investor in that company. So there's a lot of elite buy-in to sort of getting control of this territory. And of course, Dunmore also has some interest in just sort of distracting colonists from the brewing revolution, right? By 1774, you know, settler defiance of the imperial government in London, it has gotten really intense. We're on the sort of the eve of the Continental Congress and all of that. So the idea for Dunmore was that he might unite the colonists in Virginia in opposition to native peoples by sort of, you know, encouraging a small incident to spiral into a large war. And that incident actually was a settler massacre of the family of a member of the Mingo Nation. The leader was named Logan. There was a massacre of Logan's family on pretty much no pretext. This was the kind of the level that Indian hating had reached by this point amongst Western settlers. It's not that they were responding to a specific danger. It's not that settlers had any specific reason to target these people. In fact, Logan was very strongly dedicated to peace with settlers. He worked quite hard up until this point to maintain some kind of coexistence, even amidst all of this kind of brewing chaos. So the massacre of Logan's family for no apparent reason was one of the pretexts for the beginning of this war that pitted Mingos and Shawnees against Virginia militia. And that war was barely over by the time in 1775, you see this sort of open conflict break out between colonial militia and British forces in Massachusetts. So all of this is just to say that for all intents and purposes, in this western area, right, west of the Appalachian Mountains, in native homelands that the British government didn't really control, even though it did claim them on paper. In this territory, a lot of the native nations whose homelands those were had been at war with British colonists for the better part of two decades, right? Not always in a state of high intensity, but effectively, you know, violence was the order of the day, and settlers were continuously engaging in acts of aggression as they flooded into this territory that led native nations to defend their sovereignty, to defend their homelands violently if needed. And so by the time of the Declaration of Independence, this ongoing war just enters a new phase. That's really all that it marks. Like 1776 is not the beginning of anything. It's just a shift in conflicts that are already ongoing.
And you're saying also basically too that the Seven Years' War or the French Indian War also never ended, at least from the indigenous perspective, and maybe not from the settler perspective either.
That's right.
But you did say earlier that the Seven Years' War, there were Indian tribes fighting on both sides. So were there no groups of Indians that were aligned with the settlers, the British colonial settlers?
Oh, there definitely were.
And how did that interaction work within all of this visceral hatred of each other? How do we start thinking about these alliances then?
Well, one thing I will say is that we have a tendency to often, whether it's the revolution or, you know, the Seven Years' War, we often have a tendency to describe native nations as being on one side or the other, right? They're either on the British side or on the French side. And in some ways, that's really not an accurate portrayal of the kinds of decisions that native leaders were making.
So going all the way back to the start of our discussion, it's impossible for us to use these words to say this is how native people thought, because there are hundreds of different groupings who had hundreds of different ways of thinking about how to manage all of these things happening to them.
Yeah, I think it might be more helpful to think about it as native leaders making decisions, not because they have allegiance to the British or allegiance to the French, they're making decisions as the leaders of sovereign nations, right? So they are on their own side, and they're going to do what they think is best for their people, what is best for their nation. Now, sometimes that does mean engaging in violence, right? That sometimes that does mean participating in war.
And maybe changing sides if it's appropriate.
Right. But in many cases, I think even in the majority of cases, especially during the revolution, native leaders were not keen to choose sides. By this point, you know, they had a lot of experience in you know, European colonization, and they knew how destructive it could be when they got caught between different European powers, right? Britain and France used native nations as proxies whenever they could, and native peoples never win those conflicts, right? No matter which European empire wins, they lose. They lose people, they lose territory. It's very destructive for them. So that's to say that during this period in the imperial crisis, right, in the 1760s and early 70s, a lot of native nations are not necessarily, let's say, what they are trying to do is maintain the peace, right? They are trying to, in many ways, do what the imperial government in London is trying to do, right, which is prevent unrestrained settlement. They're trying to prevent violence, you know, small-scale violence from spinning out of control. They are trying to resolve differences through diplomatic means. You know, I mentioned the Mingo leader, Logan. He was one of the many, many native leaders who often responded to colonial provocations with an attempt to sort of reach across and, you know, restore peace in one way or another. So it's not that all native nations were at war with Britain, right? I don't want to give that impression. And in fact, a lot of native nations were just doing whatever they could to protect their homelands and protect their sovereignty in the face of a very sort of chaotic process of settler expansion. So that actually, you know, I mean, maybe that is a good segue to the sort of the 1775-76 moment, because in fact, when violence breaks out between American colonists and British soldiers, virtually all native peoples at that point see this as none of their business. They're like, this is a civil war for white people. We're not getting involved. There was one Mohawk leader that said, our mind is only of peace, right? So there was no desire for native peoples to get in the middle of this this conflict within the British Empire, this civil war. And it's only over the course of the development of the revolution that ends up changing.
Fascinating. So yeah, let's get to the text again of the Declaration. And then I just want to talk about how the native peoples, as news came, how they understood what it meant. But I'm struck that of all of the grievances against King George, I've count at least 27 in the list of complaints against King George. And it's funny, just from a compositional standpoint, that the merciless Indian savages comes as number 27 out of 27, almost as if it's an addendum that the committee, or Thomas Jefferson plus the committee writing it, were like, oh, we forgot, maybe we should add this for our constituents out there in the Appalachian with their issues. Is that a totally wrong reading?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure that it is quite that tactical.
Well, but why 27 of all, you know, why not number 10? It just seems weird that it's the last one. That's all.
It does. And you know, it is relevant that at least in any organized sense, by the time the Declaration is written and adopted, in fact, the British government is not in any way trying to, you know, like, quote unquote, endeavored to bring on the inhabitants, the merciless Indians. British policy in 1776 is actually to keep native peoples out of it. They think at that point that this is something that can be sort of, you know, managed quickly on their own, or at least, you know, hopefully, without turning it into some sort of, you know, chaotic continent-spanning general war. So the British are not keen until 1777 to involve native peoples. So the idea that somehow the British are inciting or have already incited native violence against settlers is just not accurate, unless we're counting this sort of, you know, this unregulated situation in the West, which is kind of out of everyone's control, right? So, you know, I don't think it's unreasonable to view that as a way of trying to enlist the loyalties of settlers in the West. It is definitely relevant that this, you know, sort of accusation of the king inciting native peoples against colonists is lumped together with the beginning of this grievance, which is excited domestic insurrections, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a direct reference to, I mean, domestic insurrections is sort of a euphemism here for slave revolts, as it is throughout the colonial period. And so this is a direct reference to Lord Dunmore's proclamation enlisting, like offering freedom for people of African descent, enslaved people who join up with the British military, right? Who are willing to serve against American rebels. So that, you know, that was something that did in fact alienate a lot of colonists in the South, right? That this was just such a beyond the pale move for someone like a British administrator to enlist enslaved people. So maybe it's also worth asking why that is number 27, right? Why that one is the last grievance as well.
Well, this would have affected Jefferson, of course, who had, I think, hundreds, dozens mm-hmm. or hundreds of enslaved people.
Yeah.
So just my final question before we conclude. 4th of July, I guess in Pennsylvania, there are bells ringing, the declaration is read out, it goes out to be printed at various newspapers and stuff. How are all of these hundreds of different native tribes learning about this, and how are they reacting? And I know they probably had hundreds of different reactions, but generally speaking, do they care? Are they like, oh my God, this is bad for us? Are they reading this number 27 grievance saying, oh, here they have calling us merciless Indian savages. We better get ready for even more war.
Mm. Yeah, so this does depend a great deal on which nation we're talking about. For example, on July 3rd, 1776, Cherokee fighters from several different towns are attacking South Carolina, Western mm-hmm. South Carolina. And they're not doing it because the British, you know, incited them. They're doing it because this is part of Cherokee politics, right? It's because of situations between Western settlers and the Cherokee settlements, the Cherokee towns, that has spiraled up to this point of Cherokee leaders such as Dragon Canoe deciding that this was the time to try to attack settlers. So that has nothing to do at all with the Declaration of Independence. It just happens to be at exactly the same time. I think for Dragon Canoe and other Cherokee leaders, the Declaration probably would not have meant anything. The real significance of the Declaration for Native Nations was not the part that has endured over centuries, that has to do with the kind of the ideals that are articulated in the very beginning, the sort of, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident part. The important thing about the Declaration was the independence part, because from Native perspectives, what this effectively meant was that suddenly it's not just a British Empire where the center in London is trying to restrain British colonists on, you know, the sort of the Western territories. Instead, it's now two different political units. And one of them, the British government based in London and its agents in North America, that's the only political entity that has been trying to restrain the chaotic violence that's been erupting in the West. And now they are weakened. And instead, you have a new polity. You have the United States, which is composed of all of those settlers and the settler leaders who have been inciting violence, who have been invading native homelands, whose leaders are land speculators who have an interest in acquiring this land, right? So the United States is a very dangerous entity for Native peoples. It sort of represents all of the forces that they have been struggling against and without the restraining influence of the British government anymore. So that's the part of the declaration that really matters to them, is just the fact that now they have a new and potentially deeply hostile political confederation that they have to figure out how to deal with.
Great. You're almost done. One of the things that I learned from talking to you is how power centers that are far away have difficulties managing how people behave where they are at. So, you know, it's hard for just like it was difficult for people in Washington, D.C. to manage Afghanistan and Iraq, right? And whatever you might think there and whatever policies you put in place aren't necessarily going to have much of an effect on someone living their life far away. Mm. So there's that idea of disconnection that I see. And I guess also this idea of tribalism. And I don't mean tribalism in the sense of indigenous tribes, the way you were describing how obviously the native tribes were banding together. And when push came to shove, they were their tribe. And when a settler community came, they were their tribe. And then they would fight and then do terrible things. I'm almost getting a very pessimistic and cynical lesson from our talk today. Yeah, tribalism is the norm. So maybe bring me up from there to something more positive.
Well,
I mean, it's a tough history.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that I am going to be able to give an uplifting takeaway.
That's
I think,
fine.
You know, the things that strike me, you know, when I teach this document, which I do every year in one class or another, is, you know, the Declaration of Independence has been, I mean, I think it's not an exaggeration to say it's kind of a landmark in human history. Like it really marks an enormous and an incredible development in the promulgation of ideals that are so stunningly amazing and important. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, I think that sentence has been inspiring to generation after generation, not only in the US, but around the world. And that's real and that's important. I think it's relevant that generation after generation of people in the United States have laid claim to the Declaration in a way that has tried to sort of challenge the nation to live up to that statement, right? Whether it's, you know, the like early women's rights movement, the Declaration of Sentiments at Seneca Falls that basically models the Declaration of Independence and just says that all men and women are created equal and builds on that. Or, you know, sometimes more negative or more critical perspectives, like the abolitionist Frederick Douglass's speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July, right? Again, sort of, you know, calling on the ideals of the Declaration to be something that is actually a real, like made real, made manifest, and not just an empty sentiment. The flip side of that is that this last grievance suggests that there are ways in which the seemingly universal ideals expressed in the beginning of the Declaration are maybe not quite as universal as we like to think. It seems as though, you know, this really troubling category of, you know, quote unquote, merciless Indian savages, it seems kind of implicit that they were not created equal, that they did not have inalienable rights, and that they are not entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness the way that supposedly all men were. Instead, this category suggests that No, they were merciless Indians who knew nothing but destruction. And so there's a kind of a way in which whatever it is that the United States is that comes out of the Declaration, whatever new nation emerges from this, doesn't really have room for Native people. It's a kind of a constitutive exclusion that almost predicates the existence of the United States on the sort of the exclusion of Native people from, the common cause of the revolution and the nation that it creates. So I think in a lot of ways it is helpful to, I don't know, a big part of me doesn't want to resolve that discomfort. I think that that discomfort is actually something that can be productive if we don't sweep it under the rug, if we really, confront it and think about it and consider what the implications are throughout American history and today, right? What this all means for the future of the United States and the ideals that it was founded upon or articulated upon its founding, and what it says about the very complicated and anomalous position that Native nations continue to hold within the United States even now, right? Within this nation that is also still a colonial power that rules over 574 different Native nations. I think sitting with that discomfort hopefully invites further discussion and ultimately, not just discussion, but motion. Motion in a way that grapples with maybe whatever it is, the next step that makes good on these ideals. Like if we take that second paragraph really seriously and ask ourselves, what does that imply for the future of Native nations in the United States? What does justice demand?
Professor Matthew Coor, thank you so much. And everyone, thanks for listening.
Liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.